The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
An enormous radio telescope with more than 2,000 antennas began operating recently in Australia. The system, known as the Murchison Wide Field Array Telescope, will allow physicists to get an unprecedented view of our universe's earliest stages. On this edition of UWM Today, we're going to visit with a UWM scientist who will be doing research on that new telescope. Joining us in the studio is David Kaplan. David is an assistant professor of physics and a member of the Leonard E. Parker Center for Gravitation, Cosmology, and Astrophysics at UW-Milwaukee. Welcome, Dave. Good to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And I said you're going to be doing research on this new telescope, but you actually already have begun to do so.
That's right. So the telescope was only officially turned on in June, but we've really been using it for about the last 4 years to learn how it works and get everything up and running.
This is just amazing. As I did the background for this program, we're talking about this amazing piece of equipment with already 2,000 antennas. You're still only in the first phase of a complete build-out that is still underway.
That's right. So the project that we have now is known as the Murchison Wide Field Array, and this is a Pathfinder experiment for the International Square Kilometer Array. So the Square Kilometer Array is a project that will have many times the number of antennas that we have. And the Square Kilometer Array, or SKA, is being built in two different places, one of which is the place in Australia where we have the Murchison Wide Field Array. So this project, which we hope to be completed in about 6 or 10 years from now, will be an enormous advance over what we have now. But we need to begin using the Murchison Wide Field Array now so that we understand how the technology works and what sort of science we'll be doing when it's all activated.
So for those of us who aren't physicists and may not understand much about how these giant telescopes work, give us a layman's explanation of exactly how you are able to go ahead and look so far back into the universe's history with a piece of equipment that's operating today.
That's a very good question. And the answer comes because the universe is expanding. And so when the universe expands, light becomes redder. It gets redshifted. And so what we're looking to do with the Murchison Wide Field Array is look at a very particular kind of light. We're looking to look at the kind of light that was emitted by hydrogen atoms and the very earliest time of the universe. So when we look at these hydrogen atoms today, they emit light with a wavelength that's a very particular wavelength. It has a wavelength of about 21 centimeters, so maybe the size of your arm. And that wavelength is a radio wavelength that we can see with radio telescopes all over the Earth. But when you go back in time, that wavelength gets longer and longer. It gets redshifted. And so if we look back to the very earliest times in the universe, that wavelength ends up being several meters in size. And so it ends up having a frequency which is right about the same frequency as this radio station, right in the FM band. So that's in fact why we put the telescope where we did, in the middle of nowhere in Western Australia, because we have to get it as far away from all the lovely radio stations like WUWM, because they would make too much noise in the foreground for us. So we need to get away from everybody as much as possible. All of your cell phones, your garage door openers, your Wi-Fi, your radio stations, your TV stations, even car spark plugs, those are all problematic for us. So we basically segregate ourselves as far away as possible from everybody.
And have you discovered if you are far enough away, is it working?
Well, we think it's working so far. This is a long-term experiment. It will take several years of collecting data and some very careful analysis to figure out whether we've seen exactly the signal that we think we can see. We've done the calculations using early data from the telescope, and we think that we will be sensitive enough, but we still got to do it. So we got to sit there, and we're going to look at the same patch of sky for several thousand hours. And then we're going to have some of the smartest people around the planet look at that data for probably another couple years. And then hopefully we'll have an answer, yes or no. And if we see it, it'll just be the very tip of what we can understand. We will more or less know, have we seen it or have we not seen it? And by see it, I mean this signal from these ancient hydrogen atoms. But what we really want to do is we want to understand what that signal has to tell us. And that's the motivation for building out these bigger and more advanced telescopes. It's not just knowing whether or not we've seen the signal, but learning from it.
So are these radio waves floating out there somewhere, and or are they all around us and we just haven't quite figured out how to zero in on them?
They're all floating out there, just like light from stars is always coming in, but during the daytime you can't see it because the sun is too bright. So we need to have a very big telescope in a very, very radio quiet location in order to collect these very faint radio waves. If you added up all of the radio energy collected by all of the radio telescopes on the Earth since radio astronomy started in the 1960s, it might boil a cup of water.
It's that weak.
It's that weak. Whereas this station, I don't know for a fact, but probably has a power of kilowatts to megawatts.
Right.
So that would boil a cup of water in milliseconds.
So it literally is like looking for that needle in the haystack. It's a very small piece in a great, great big sky.
That's right.
So tell us about the processing for this. I mean, I get it. You've got these thousands of antenna that are set up all essentially like sponges. You're trying to pull it in. But what happens when they do pick up a signal? Where do you go ahead and process all of this?
Well, the processing is very complicated. So the normal type of radio telescope that maybe people have seen in something like the movie Contact or something like that is basically a really, really big satellite dish. And that works well, except it's sort of like taking a picture of the sky with a one-pixel camera. So the camera that you have in your pocket probably has a few million pixels. So you can take a picture and you can see your family. You can see your dog or whatever. If you had a one-pixel camera, it would take you a really long time to make a nice picture of your family. You'd have to take a picture of your wife's nose, move it over, take a picture of her eye, move it over, take a picture of her ear, and so on. And it would be really, really labor-intensive. And by splitting up the telescope into all these little pieces, we can actually use some advanced mathematical techniques to reconstruct an image of the whole sky with only one picture. So it enables us to have, in essence, a megapixel camera operating at radio wavelengths.
So it's sort of like a mosaic where you've got little tiny squares or pieces of an image that ultimately come together.
That's right. But we take a whole lot of data. So I've been working with data on my computer at work right now, and we store about 40 gigabytes of data after only having recorded about 2 minutes of the night sky. So over the course of a single night, we'll record about 14 terabytes of data. So just dealing with the sheer volume of the data is really a challenge, especially because we're in the middle of nowhere. So it's not like we can just sort of send it out over Wi-Fi. So we have to have a dedicated fiber optic link from the nearest town in Australia, which is pretty small, to the observatory. And then once we get it from there, we move it down to a supercomputing center outside Perth, which is the major city in that region of Australia. And then just getting it from Perth to my desk is also a bit of a challenge. So this means that I have to have dedicated computers in the Center for Gravitation, Cosmology, and Astrophysics that just store and process this data. So it takes, from 2 minutes of data, it will take us maybe 3 or 4 hours in order to generate an image. We're working to try to get that more to 2 minutes of data taking 2 minutes of time, but that requires having many, many computers operating all at once.
So you leave Milwaukee periodically to go to Australia and actually do work on site?
Well, I don't actually go on site. I was supposed to go on site a couple of years ago, but this is in the desert in Australia. Even though it's a desert, though, it rained, and a truck turned over, and it blocked the one road that would get you from the city to the site. So my trip was canceled. But we can only actually have a few people on site at once. It's not really a place where people like to spend a lot of time. There's very little in the way of resources. So we do this almost all via computer. So I go to Australia regularly, but it's mostly so that I can interact with my colleagues down there. This is an international project. It's people from the US, from Australia, from New Zealand, and from India. So periodically, we all get together and discuss what the latest advances and problems are. So that's mostly why I go to Australia. I'd really like to make it out to the site. It looks like a really fascinating place. I've seen many amazing pictures, but we can only have about 4 people there at a time. And we actually try to keep those people at their desks in Perth so they can do a lot more work. They only go out to the middle of the desert when they need to sort of unscrew some nuts and bolts and fix the computers that are broken or things like that.
So the real heavy lifting takes place when physicists are looking at the data that's coming in out of those thousands of antenna that are sitting out in the desert.
That's right. So we have people all over the world looking at these data, and trying to understand exactly what they mean and how we can understand things and how we can make better and more clear images.
Do you have any thesis, any hypotheses of what where this information might take you in terms of a better or deeper understanding about the universe?
So one of the big questions that this is trying to answer is how the universe ended up the way it did. So we know that when the universe started out, it was really, really, really hot. So the universe was almost entirely hydrogen at that point. But it was so hot that the hydrogen didn't form the atom that we can sort of draw from chemistry class. It didn't have an electron orbiting around the proton. Instead, the electron got kicked off into interstellar space because it was too hot. So it became just ions. And then eventually, the hydrogen gas got cooler and cooler and cooler, and the ions all found, every proton found an electron, and they formed nice, happy atoms again. But then eventually, things started happening in the universe. And when I say things, I mean the first stars and galaxies started to form. And when these first stars and galaxies started to form, they put out a lot of energy. Our sun is very bright. The first stars that formed were many thousands of times brighter than our sun. And they put out so much energy that they caused all this hydrogen gas to become ions again. But we don't actually know exactly when and how that happened. So one of the major goals for the telescope is studying what we call the epoch of reionization. That's the time in the history of the universe when the gas went from neutral hydrogen gas to this ionized gas. And what we're looking to do is understand why that happened. What caused it to happen? Was it single really, really big stars? Was it a lot of smaller stars? When did it happen? When did these stars and galaxies form? Did they all form in really big groups, or were they scattered out throughout space? So those are questions that we want to answer. And I don't actually have any particular hypothesis that I've been pushing with that. I'm just looking to see where the data take us.
You talked about the universe continuing to expand. What impact does that have in our understanding of the beginning of the universe, knowing that it still is spreading out?
Well, it isn't really affecting things that we do right now. The expansion is really only relevant if you're looking back billions of years. So over the time of human civilization, the expansion hasn't really changed things very much. Going forward, we do want to understand what's going to happen to the universe. What will the eventual fate of it be? And some really interesting work has been coming in over the last few years, work looking at very distant supernova explosions. And they can show that those supernova explosions are indicating that not only is the universe expanding, it's expanding faster and faster as time goes on. So that's caused by something that we don't understand at all called dark energy. Dark energy is really just some sort of name we put on something that we don't understand in this case. So the universe is expanding and it's expanding.
And there's supposed to be a lot of it out there, right?
There's a lot of it out there. It's most of what's out there. But we still really don't know what it means. So there are a lot of other experiments, not our particular experiment, but there are a lot of other experiments that are ongoing right now and that are planned for the next few years that will help us figure out what this dark energy is.
Have we seen dark energy and just don't understand it, or is it just a theory that it's there?
We can see the effects of it, right? If you are looking at a kung fu movie and you see some guy fly up off the ground, you know that he's really being pulled by a wire, even if you can't see the wire. So we can see the effects of this dark energy on the movement of galaxies billions of years ago. But we haven't actually been able to nail down and write an equation to show you what it is or reproduce anything like it in our labs.
Is there a sense among your fellow scientists that we someday will be able to figure this out back here on Earth by looking outwards? Or is there a belief that perhaps we actually have to go out deeper into space and encounter this dark energy?
Well, dark energy is everywhere. And so going out into space wouldn't really help you. The distance that we can get out into space, well, space is closer than Minneapolis. When you're out in space, it's really not very far away. Even if you go to the moon, that's still only 250,000 miles away. When we're talking about these galaxies where dark energy becomes important, they're billions of light years away. So it's just so much further that going into space doesn't really help you find this stuff. What going into space does is it helps you measure it. So things like the Hubble Space Telescope, it was crucial to finding this dark energy in the first place, and that's because it sits above our atmosphere. So if you want to take really, really steady measurements, you need to get away from the atmosphere because that causes a lot of the light from these stars to become absorbed. It also causes the light to become wavy. If you look at stars at night, they twinkle. the Hubble Space Telescope gets above the atmosphere so the stars don't twinkle and we can take much sharper pictures.
And there you're actually taking images of that light that is coming in. In the Murchison telescope, the wide field array telescope that you're working on, you're looking at the radio waves.
That's right. It's all more or less the same thing. Light, radio waves, infrared, it's all light. It's just light of different wavelengths. So our eyes are tuned to respond to light of a certain wavelength, and that's what we call visual light. But you could have light with a shorter wavelength. That's what we would call ultraviolet. Even shorter still would be X-rays. Or longer wavelengths would be infrared and then radio waves. So it's all basically the same underlying physical process. It just looks different to us. But it does mean that we need different technology to measure it.
So why build this research station here on Earth with these thousands of antenna? Couldn't you just put a really cool satellite up in space and accomplish the same thing without having to make the kind of huge investment in antennas that cover the landscape?
Well, what we really need for this project is a whole lot of metal. We need to collect radio waves, and as you know, if you have a bigger antenna on your FM radio, you can collect signals that are further off, and our signals are coming from really, really far off, so we need a really big antenna. Now, we'd love to go into space. That would have some advantages for us, but satellites are really expensive. If you want to launch material up in satellites, even for the cheapest satellites that are coming online now, where it's done by companies and not by governments, it's still thousands or tens of thousands of dollars a kilogram. Whereas we can build our antennae for about $50 each. So it makes much more sense for us to put them in the middle of the desert. And that also means that if something breaks, we can fix it. If you have all these things floating around in space, you can't fix them. But that said, there is a very ambitious plan to put a similar but bigger telescope on the far side of the moon. And the advantage there is twofold. Number one is that you'd get away from any conceivable source of radio coming from other people.
WUWM's radio signal would not be out there.
Well, we'd put in a repeater just for you. Okay. In general, no. But aside from that, the other main advantage is that part of the radio signals that we receive are limited because of our Earth's atmosphere. For the most part, radio waves go through the atmosphere, but there are certain types of radio waves that are blocked. And so if you go to the moon, those radio waves would not be blocked either.
Amazing. You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. So good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and joining us in the studio is Dave Kaplan. Dave is an assistant professor of physics at UWM. He's also a member of the Leonard E. Parker Center for Gravitation, Cosmology, and Astrophysics at UWM. And I should note, Dave, that your physics department on campus really not only has a national but an international reputation by virtue of the good work that you and your colleagues have been doing over many, many years.
That's right. And we participate in a number of international projects designed not just to look at radio waves, but to look at a number of different types of astronomical signals and a lot of different types of things. We're very involved in building a project that's looking at a different type of signal called gravitational waves. And these are ripples in the fabric of space-time. I'm not particularly involved in that, but it's a really exciting project. And we're hopeful that this time in history, we are about to turn on the final generation of facility that will finally detect these things, which were predicted almost 100 years ago by Einstein.
Wow, wow. One of the areas that I do want to get into in our interview today relates back to the work that you've been discussing in the first half of the program, that wonderful wide field array telescope, the Murchison in Australia, where, as you point out, perhaps it will lead to some better, deeper understandings of how our universe evolved. But you've discovered that you can use this same sort of telescope system to look at some of the stuff that we end up discarding in space.
That's right. Now, I don't know how many people in the audience have seen the movie Gravity. I personally haven't seen it. But from what I understand of the premise, there are astronomers working on the Hubble Space Telescope, and they end up having a difficult situation because their space shuttle is destroyed by pieces of other satellites. And this is what we call space debris. And this is an enormous problem. The only satellite of the country, Ecuador, was destroyed earlier this year by some space debris. There was a satellite from the Iridium satellite phone system that was destroyed by a collision with another satellite about a year ago. it's an increasingly big problem for satellites that are orbiting in what we call low Earth orbit. So that means that they orbit the Earth at an altitude of about 300 kilometers.
And I've heard that it's not just a few hundred, it's thousands of pieces of space junk that are out there.
That's right. And whenever any one of these pieces of space junk encounters something else, it makes more pieces of space junk. These things are moving really fast. And so when one piece hits another satellite, it breaks into many, many pieces of smaller debris. And then those can then create smaller and smaller debris. So it's an enormous problem, not just for the safety of people up in orbit, but mostly for satellites.
And right now there is an attempt to track this stuff, right?
That's right. And there is an ongoing effort by NASA and the Air Force and the international community ways to track this. And what they do is they have expensive dedicated facilities that they use, and they do a very good job of understanding a lot of what's going on. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to understand a different way to do that, which is not using a dedicated facility, but that is using this Murchison Wide Field Array for more than one purpose at the same time. And so what we found is that there are many strong radio stations on Earth. And even though they're not close enough to our telescope for us to receive those radio waves directly, those radio waves will go up into space. WUWM is going up into space right now. And those radio waves will reflect off pieces of debris or reflect off satellites that are orbiting around the Earth. And once it reflects off, it will bounce down towards the Earth, and then we can receive them with our telescope in Australia. And because we can cover such a huge area of the sky, we can figure out where these pieces of debris are, where they're going, what their orbits are, and understand how many of them and what size. So right now, we're just still at the very beginning of understanding this. We're used to looking at things that are millions and billions of light years away. So looking at things that are only a few hundred kilometers away actually requires changing our mindset a little bit and doing some different types of math with the data. So we've demonstrated that we can do this, and right now we're trying to understand what is it good for, how does it fit into the national picture of how we monitor space debris, how does this fit into the overall international way of doing these things, and this is something where our telescope and the larger Square Kilometer Array that will come online hopefully in the next 10 years, we'll be able to make a major contribution to this field.
How does NASA feel about this?
We've had some initial conversations with NASA and with people in the Air Force. They think it's interesting. They're still waiting to see exactly how useful it is. We've had some conversations with the Australian government as well, and they also think it's interesting, and we're working with them to try to develop a little bit further forward to see just what can we do, just what can we offer them, and how does that fit into the bigger picture. I don't have a very good appreciation of the bigger picture because a lot of it's classified. So we have to sort of feed bits and pieces of what we're doing to the people who know the whole story, and they can tell us, you might want to concentrate in this area or that area.
Do you think there's any fear on the part of both our government and perhaps other countries that do have secret spy satellites up there that you might learn too much?
I don't think that's their biggest worry. There are a lot of people out there, amateur astronomers, who spend a lot of time tracking and monitoring satellites. And they're very good at seeing the bigger satellites that you can see with sort of your backyard telescope. And you can go and find the online forums where they'll tell you exactly where those things are and things like that. If there are worries about what we're doing, well, they haven't told me yet. So we'll see.
You really got me interested in the whole process of the world of discovery in physics. Let me ask you, Dave, how did you first become interested in this? I mean, you're working with colleagues from all around the world now. Where in your life did you say, this is something I want to do more of?
That's a sort of interesting story. When I was younger, I was an amateur astronomer, and what that means is that I had a small telescope and I would go out into my backyard or go out to the front yard and look up at the stars and say, well, that's really cool, and find this planet or find this galaxy. But it was just a hobby, and I'd occasionally get together with other friends and we'd do this, but it was just sort of the thing you do occasionally on the weekend. But at the same time, I was also in school. I was studying science, and I thought that physics was really cool, and that's what I wanted to do as a career. So when I got into college, I started trying to find an internship that would allow me to do a little bit of research. And I knew that I was a freshman in college. I didn't have much to offer, but I hoped that I could somehow be useful for students, for some professor to do some research project. And I asked around, and I asked around, and everybody was sort of busy and full. And then I found one person who had an opportunity for me to do research, and that happened to be in the astronomy department. And until then, it hadn't really occurred to me that astronomy was just physics, just looking in the other direction, really. So that was the first time when I realized that astronomy could be a career and not just a hobby. And that's really more or less what I've been doing ever since.
What university was it?
That was at Cornell University.
And were there others like you who also were thinking, you know, gee, maybe astronomy is a career path?
I hope so. I know there are a number of other students at Cornell. We actually have a great group of students here at UWM that we get involved in research at a very early time in their career. So we have students from their first semester in college, we get them involved in cutting-edge astronomical research. They get to control some of the world's largest radio telescopes and work with an international team of collaborators in a hunt for new pulsars. These are the remains of exploded stars that are spinning many, many times a second. So later this afternoon, I will get together with our group of undergraduates and we'll talk about what the latest work they've done is. And we'll see what we're going to do over the next few weeks.
So these are 18, 19, 20-year-olds.
They are. And some of them have gone on to careers in graduate school to study physics and astronomy. Some of them have gone on to do entirely different things. We have some who have gone to start their own companies in the Milwaukee area. But they've told us that they very much appreciate this grounding in physics and astronomy that they've gotten from us.
So where do you see your career going? I mean, you're a young guy and you've had these amazing experiences. Do you think you're going to focus on the work that you're doing in Australia right now, for example, looking at these low radio frequency waves?
I'm hopeful that this will be a very promising area in the years to come. So the Murchison Wide Field Array we're using for the next few years, and we're hoping that it will spur enough development that we can start this Square Kilometer Array project, which will carry on into the next decade. At the same time, we're hopeful that this gravitational wave project that we're working on here at UWM, the next few years will be a really exciting time there. Gravitational waves come from stars that explode or stars that sort of crash violently into each other. And we're trying to see if we can see these crashes of stars, both in gravitational waves, which are ripples in the fabric of space-time, but also in normal light. And so one of my major projects for the next few years is understanding how do we do that and getting everything ready, all the tools at our disposal ready, so that when the first one of these signals is received, we'll be able to understand everything about it as soon as possible.
So it's figuring, it's actually building the net, learning how to build the net, and then ultimately using that net to capture this information.
That's right. A lot of the hardware, a lot of the telescopes are already existing around the world, although, of course, we're still trying to build bigger and better ones. But it's understanding how to bring all that information together and how to process it quickly and efficiently, understand the types of signals that we want to look for and the types of signals that are just going to be sort of in the background distracting us. That's really the challenge over the next few years.
And in the community of scientists, do people all cooperate regardless of their nationality or religion?
Yeah, this is an international project. There are scientists from Europe and the U.S. deeply involved. We're expanding now into India and Japan. It's really an international thing. You don't know if the signal that you see, if the star that explodes, will it be in the northern hemisphere that we can see it from the U.S., or will it be in the southern hemisphere where we need to use telescopes in Chile? Will it be daytime in the U.S. and nighttime in China? We don't really know, so we have to talk to people everywhere.
Great lesson for your students in teamwork, right?
Definitely.
Dave, fascinating conversation. We wish you the very, very best as you continue your work in astronomy and bringing that great physics love or background that you've got to UWM.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you very much.
Dave Kaplan, an assistant professor of physics at UWM, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. Well, that's all for this week's show. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You have been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.